Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia, and we are streaming live on the Countercurrents, DLive, and Odyssey channels. We are running the Writer's Block, and with me here tonight is James J. O'Meara of the Sochamus of the Clan Omidra, a great and powerful wizard, and we will be discussing Better Call Saul tonight. But James, how are you doing tonight?
Hi, Nix. I'm fine.
Oh, you're going to do the impression, right? I was going to do the impression, but it got away from me because when I'm in show mode, I do the whole hello and welcome to the Writer's Block, and it's basically on rails. I'm Nick Jillian. Did you know you have rights? The Constitution says so, and I agree. But
one of the nice things I just noticed about that little commercial of his is that what he says is, I forget the exact details, but he says, I believe everybody in Albuquerque is innocent until proven guilty. I said, wait a second. You should stop after innocent. That's until proven guilty. Well, you know, if I lose the case, you're on your own. You're guilty. There you go. My job is done. My job is done.
You got to play to the audience's expectations. You know, we do live in a world where people watch TV, and so they pick up these bits and pieces of legal lingo. Yeah. So you have to actually resonate with what they think they know about the legal system, which is not quite a lot. Something in my 6 years as an attorney, I learned that people know jack shit about the law.
That's why they pay you so much money.
Exactly. However, before we get into it, and you know, it's always with James O'Meara, you got to get into it. I can hardly control this guy. You know, it's like in the cartoons. I'm holding him back, and he's saying, "Let me at him, let me at him." But we do have crass financial concerns to address. Yeah. You know that we have to introduce the show properly. So, to anyone who is maybe a newcomer, maybe doesn't know, we are having a fundraiser on Countercurrents, which means we are raising funds. Now, we just completed the matching grant, the Columbus Day special matching grant. However, that does not mean that our goal has been attained. I believe that only 60% of the fundraising goal has been attained, and we are running out of year. So I'm just going to activate the banner here. And so we are taking donations on Entropy, and you can go to entropystream.live/countercurrents and donate. And you can ask me question. You can ask James question. I'm sure I'm not the only Saul head in the dissident right and among white nationalists. I'm sure that there are many other fans of James Saul Goodman McGill. And anything you wanted me to know about that subject or any other, you're free to ask me. You're free to ask James, and you can do that through Entropy by attaching a question to your donation. Now, maybe you don't have a question. Maybe you just want to give out of the goodness of your heart. Now, you can do that through Cash App. We have the Cash App link in the chat, and of course on the ticker tape. Now, you can't ask questions through Cash App, but they do take a lesser percentage of the donation than Entropy. So, you know, you got nothing to ask. You just want to give. Cash App is the way. There's, of course, MoonPay. Now, MoonPay, you can use your credit card to give us Countercurrents. Just type in the your credit card info, and the appropriate sum will be converted into cryptocurrency and forwarded to the Countercurrents wallets. And then you have DLive and Odyssey. We are monetized on both platforms. You can donate lemons and ice creams and ninjets and ninja guineas and even the elusive diamond over on DLive. And those are the tokens. Those are the tokens associated with the site. They're convertible directly to, real currency, even though they sound silly. And you can also attach questions to donations of diamond and higher. And, of course, you can donate over on Entropy. On Entropy, you can give us cash tips. And people have been having trouble finding the cash tip button, I hear. So what happens is you type out your message in the chat box. And when you do, the dollar sign button comes online and you can associate a cash tip with your comment. And that way I can read it out and you can ask questions and you can leave comments. And you can do the same thing with Library Coin, which is Odyssey's very own cryptocurrency associated with the Library Foundation. I'm not sure of the conversion rate to American dollars, but you know what I say, every little bit helps. And well, before we get into it, before we get into the show, I have to address a donation which Greg missed yesterday. Let me just find it here in our archive. So yesterday, Dino Legovic, a regular viewer of the show, donated one American dollar over on Odyssey, and he said, "My suitcase is very small." And this is in reference to the magical suitcases full of cash that Greg mentioned would materialize should a content creator choose to sell his morals to the Kremlin. Such a cash suitcase did materialize yesterday, but it was so small that Greg overlooked it, and it only really holds $1. Where does anyone have the clip of Stefan Molyneux doing the one fecking dollar thing? I miss that guy. Now, he was like the comic relief of the universe. Yeah. Now, those are all the direct ways you could donate to Countercurrents. You can help our fundraiser. However, there is an indirect way you can help us, and that is by purchasing the fine products of our sponsor and friend, Alaska Chaga. And for the people listening to the replay audio, that's the sound of me slurping down Alaska Chaga tea, a delicious, refreshing drink full of antioxidants. Puts me right to sleep after the show, obviously. And it's good for you. They scrape or rip the mushrooms out of the mulberry trees or the beech trees up in Alaska. I don't know. I'm not really familiar with the process. But it's good for you. I've been drinking it for we're getting close to a year now, and what can I say? I'm supremely satisfied with this fine product. Now, they also sell a range of soaps and other products, so you just go to alaskachaga.us and check out everything they have to offer. I think that's all of the crass financial concerns for tonight. I think that, we just ran through them all those ways you can support the show. Yeah. You know what they say, there's no such thing as a free lunch, and the live streams are going to be free for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. However, it is important to keep the operation running, and the operation, believe you me, people, eats money like Saul eats, what was that ice cream he likes, the one that got him in the end? Mint ice cream.
Oh, right. I can't recall. I can't. But yeah, there's some brand. I can't recall. Shame on me. I don't know. I don't know whether the suitcase is full of cash meme comes from. But I do recall, at least as far back as 1948, I think the story was that the Israeli embassy delivered a suitcase of cash to Harry Truman. In return for early recognition of Israel or something like that. There we are. That may be the original suitcase of cash. Maybe it's at the Harry Truman Museum. We could check that out.
Maybe they kept the cash. Maybe they got the suitcase and the scuttlebutt was full of cash. That's interesting because I think that Harry Truman is often cited as America's poorest president. So,
You mean economically poor, not just in talent or anything like that. Our poorest president.
Yeah, I meant it in the financial sense. You would use the qualifier worst, right, when referring to performance. I believe that title belongs to James Buchanan for the time being. Worst president yet.
Well, I don't know if the dissident right would agree, you know, because he's called that because of his dithering leading up to the Civil War, and so I guess it depends on whether you what your views on the Civil War are. Because I mean, supposedly he was covertly pro-Southern or something like that. That's why he wasn't, so retroactively he becomes one of the bad guys, you know, that sort of thing. But Yeah. I mean, Harry Truman is probably poor, retrospectively, considering, the tens of millions of dollars, starting with the Clintons in particular, the hundreds of millions of dollars these people would rake in. But he had his hands in many a till. I mean, he came from the Pendergrass organization, which was the mayor of Kansas City, who was all mobbed up and ran the whole city, which is why during the 30s, it was an open city, right? Liquor and prostitutes and et cetera, et cetera. So, the story is he was a humble haberdasher in Kansas City, but actually he was appointed to a judgeship by the Pendergrass machine. So he's probably getting all kinds of payoffs from them. But, for the time, it was, penny ante stuff, compared to what we would expect people to get. That's why.
Well, at least we know that Kennedy was not the first bootlegger to attain the highest office in the land. No, that honor belongs to none but Harry S. Truman. Although, the Roosevelts had their fingers in a lot of pies. I was mentioning this to Greg, that basically when he uses this term Jewish mafia mockingly, right, to refer to their close-knit nature. But I say, well, in Russia and in America, right, they really are mobbed up in the most literal sense of the way. I mentioned Meyer Lansky. I should have mentioned I was thinking about Mickey Cohen in the shower for whatever strange reason. It's, the mafia is a lot more Jewish than Hollywood would have you believe.
Yeah, indeed. And, that's the usual thing. the usual Crypsis, which is a relevant topic for Better Call Saul, but maybe we can get into that at a more opportune moment. But Crypsis plays a part in Better Call Saul, Jewish Crypsis.
Well, it is indeed. It is Crypsis, the TV show. It is how to get the adventurous Irishman, like the honest Irish attorney. Well, he's not 100% Irish, but how he transforms into this essentially Jewish creature, which is Saul Goodman, which is an interesting form of reverse Crypsis, right? And of course, James, you are yourself, Irish. I don't think you can get more Irish than O'Meara, maybe O'Brien or Murphy.
Let me offer this little tidbit of wisdom to your audience. These are the sorts of tidbits of knowledge that your financial support helps make possible for podcasts like this. So here's a true fact. Most people, most Americans at least, think that O something or Mac something is a typical Irish name, and it is not. The most common name in Ireland is Murphy, and the second most common name is Kelly. And I think you have to get down to like five or six before you start getting those stereotypical. So not all of them are like that, as one might say. I suppose it has something to do with Ellis Island or immigration or something like that. But there's plenty of Murphys and Kellys in America, too. So I don't know how I guess because it's so distinctive, the O and the Mac are distinctive.
Well, that's the... I believe it's the O and the Mac refer to the clan belonging. So when someone is an O'Meara, it means they belong to Clan O'Meara. Whereas I suppose Kelly is not indicative of, or they would be O'Kelly. That would be the original Irish form, but then goes down to Kelly.
That would be the sort of name someone would get in Hollywood, right? Let's call it, we want an Irish character. Okay, O'Kelly, yeah, we'll call him that. Or O'Murphy, yeah, we'll call him that. That's we'll have an English aristocrat. We'll call him Lord John, or rather than Sir John. I actually someone at a conference of philosophers made that blunder once when they were talking about Karl Popper. They kept trying to give him a distinguished name. They kept calling him Sir Popper rather than Sir Karl. Well, we've probably beaten
Popper. That sounds dirty in some strange way, like he's a pill popper.
What is it? Well, he was an Austrian Jew, I think. So, so the question is, what does popper mean in German? I don't think it means popper. Pop is P-O-P-P. That's an opera singer. So I think
Yeah, but a Slovakian one, Lucille Pop.
Yeah, well, maybe it's, well, you know, Austria, Slovakia. I mean, maybe his origins are in that part of the world.
Right.
That's one of those problems with those multi-ethnic empires, you know. I never understood Austro-Hungary. I never understood that. Like two totally different languages and peoples and so on. And, there's a book called Wittgenstein's Vienna that explores that topic in the first chapter, which I think is called Kaka or something like that. And because there was, they had all kinds of careful distinctions between things that were royal and imperial and royal imperial, which in German would be königlich, kaiserlich, or kaiserlich und königlich, and was known by the abbreviation KK, KK. But I just have to explore that sometime, or maybe get John Morgan or somebody to explain all this.
It's actually quite simple, because the yes. Emperor of Austria was at the same time king of Hungary, Croatia, Bohemia, and all of these places. And of course, towards the end, it was the dual monarchy. So every time he introduces himself as Emperor of Austria, he also introduces himself as King of Hungary, because theoretically the two states are co-equal in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the history of how that came about is actually very medieval. In the medieval period, it was actually not unheard of for someone to be king of two countries. At some point, the last Hungarian king, who was at the time king of two countries, right, king of Hungary and Croatia, was killed fighting the Turks. I forget his name, I forget the year, but the there were two assemblies of nobles. The first was of the Hungarian nobles, the second was of the Croatian nobles, and both elected to give the crowns of Hungary and Croatia to the Austrian king, who then became the Habsburg emperor. And there was a dissenter from the rector of Ragusa, and that's how Ragusa, also known as Dubrovnik, became an independent state. So that's basically how it happened. So the languages are not mutually intelligible. They're not even the same linguistic group.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. And I assume the peoples there, you know, the Magyar, or is that the wrong place? I assume that the Magyars and all that and so on. I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm familiar with the concept. I mean, you know, for instance, several post Henry VIII kings in England were king of Scotland, and like James the First of England was James the Sixth of Scotland, which gets confusing.
But it happened.
At least they're on the same island. They speak the same language, more or less.
Well, not at the time, no. I mean, we still have this situation where Elizabeth is essentially queen, or, well, God rest her soul, Charles III is now the king of all of these countries, which are very far away from each other. Not all of them are, you know, we know about Canada and New Zealand, but Jamaica, Barbados. He's never going to outgrow Prince Charles, is he?
He'll always be Prince Charles. He'll always be.
It is tragic, really.
Yeah.
It is tragic. But yeah, this was actually fairly common. Charles, Holy Roman Empire, he was emperors, king of Spain, duke of Austria. All of the crowned heads of Europe claimed to be kings of Jerusalem. So this is actually historically not that uncommon. The Habsburg Empire is, I would say, distinct because it never really got into the whole nation-building thing of the 18th and 19th century, where we would just absorb everything into a single imperial identity. And it was this last of the medieval-style kingdoms/empires where people owed their loyalty to a king who was not necessarily of their ethnic group, but he was their king nevertheless, and he was also king of another people. Mm-hmm. So, medieval Europe was a different place.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's a transitional thing. I mean, it makes more sense in the medieval context, but, I just imagine, what did they do in Parliament? I mean, such as it was. I mean, of course, it was an empire, but they had some kind of parliament. Hitler used to talk about the talking shop. and so on. And I imagine that's why. I mean, do they have like these Hungarian guys ranting in Hungarian and nobody can understand?
No, I mean, they had separate parliaments.
They had separate, that's what I'm saying. They had separate parliaments. So it's wacky.
It was strange. There is a joke on the internet. It's hilarious. It's when you're an Habsburg lieutenant, but you don't speak Slovak. So you get your Hungarian NCO to order your Polish soldier to translate from the Slovak scout into Hungarian, right? So he could translate to you for you into German. It caused serious problems in the First World War and every other engagement. I mean, you had people who were more or less the same ethnicity in their regiments, but the officers were all German, Austrians. Right. Yeah. And theoretically, they should have spoken the local languages, but in many cases, they didn't. And in the case of Hungarian, I don't really blame them.
But look, we have a war to fight. We can't spend 18 years in language school. So, George the First of England never spoke English, never learned English, or so I'm told. I believe I'm correct. Communicated entirely in German. They probably would have been better off if they had kept that tradition, actually.
Well, that would have been a quaint tradition for the king never to speak English. Would have made him sound more magical, probably.
Exactly. And more closely connected to the German homeland, less likely to get involved in all these wacky adventures. And of course, that's speaking of King Charles. That's why his the Prince of Wales motto on the coat of arms is German, Ich Dien.
So, wasn't that David's? What David? Edward the I forget his numbers motto.
It may have its origins there somewhere, but it's the Prince of Wales coat of arms, such as
Edward the Eighth, right? Who married Mrs. Wallace Simpson?
Well, you're talking about Edward the that one. No,
that was his motto. That was his motto as Prince of Wales.
Does it only go back to that far? Only that far? No, oh, it's interesting.
I don't know.
Maybe he was a closet Nazi. Who knows?
Well, he wasn't exactly closeted about it. He was quite unabashed about it, and in this very, how do I put this, self-confident manner, befitting a king. Too bad. I mean, he gave it all up for love. Oh, what a sad. What a maroon, as they say.
Exactly. Well, here we are then. So let's maybe, begin to sail towards Better Call Saul,
we got a little sidetrack there discussing the crowned heads of Europe. Well,
because you're an expert on Austria-Hungary, and I'm an ignoramus on it, and I'm learning so much. But our audience is probably equally divided and not at all interested in listening to my being instructed in these things. But to get back to what we were talking about, one of the things I learned in doing a little bit of prep for the show is that the writers of, you were talking about people knowing nothing about the law. The writers of Better Call Saul knew nothing about the law. And but like Socrates, they knew that they did not know. And so they prepared for writing the show. I guess when they were doing Better Call Saul, they just winged it. But when they went to start writing Better Call Saul, they decided they had to start going to courts and observing. And I suppose they imagined that they would get all kinds of knowledge about the law and so on. But the main thing that they learned, and this I think proves the validity of what they were doing, is that they spend most of their time in court waiting. Now, to establish my bona fides on these things, I spent about 15 or so years working for major, major, major law firms in New York. I was not a lawyer, but I was working for law firms. So I dealt with these people, of course. I was a little higher than Jimmy, as it was in the mailroom, but I was still not a lawyer. I was not one of them. But I observed them. And I was a law librarian. So I would be required to get things for them and do research for them and so on. And the one thing I discovered was, is that if you gave a lawyer a 6-month deadline, he wouldn't do anything until the week before. And so everything was a rush because, you know, they're very important people and these are very important issues. Well, you had 5 months to do this, sir. That's why the court gave you a 6-month extension, right? That's why. But the other thing is that in fact is what they spend most of their time doing is filing for motions for recess, motions to dismiss, motions to carry over, and so on. They hate going to court. I mean, Saul, actually, weirdly enough, Saul seemed to enjoy being in court. He was living his best life in court. But most attorneys don't go anywhere near court if they can manage it.
Why would you want to go to court? It's when I was an attorney, you go to court to when you really have to. Because I was doing damage restitution, the goal was always to settle, right?
Right. Yeah.
Because in court, it delays the payday a lot, seriously. But your payday starts moving towards you at the speed of court, which is, you know, slightly less than an asthmatic ant which with too much shopping, as to quote a great English philosopher.
Well, it works both ways. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and it's just the wheels of bureaucracy turning, and it is not as interesting as it is on Better Call Saul. I mean, if you are Saul, if you're willing to do the court romantics, it's not as interesting. But it is actually, litigation is very procedural. It's more about watching like a hawk the other guy and not letting him dictate the frame, which is harder than it seems, but less like Phoenix Wright, Ace Attorney, or Better Call Saul. It's more like, no, you're procedurally not allowed, Your Honor. Procedurally, he could not. They say dramatically objection, but it's actually objection. No,
it gets tired.
No, objection.
You get tired screaming all the time. So yeah, it just becomes objection. Obvious.
And if there are no clients present, if it's just lawyers and the judge in there, you sometimes put a little show on for the client, right? Because they want to see you fighting for them. And
you want to get their money's worth out of it, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And it's theatrics when you got civilians present in the court. But if it's just us lawyers, then we're really just swatting flies away. Maybe we don't even show up when maybe we send the paralegals to do
it. Well, yeah, exactly. It works both ways because the strategy is to delay until the let's say in a civil case, so you've got somebody who wants money from your client, so you just delay things as long as possible until they just get tired or they die or they move away or they start forgetting to show up and so on. You just delay, and they give up. Because you're the lawyer with the budget and the nice office and the secretary and so on, and you've got the other guy is like a public defender or the guy's representing himself, God help him, and so you just like you see this stuff with Trump and with Musk and his Twitter deals and things like that. It's all just document production and endless delays. Musk's Twitter deal keeps getting delayed, and the Waukesha Christmas parade massacre guy is only now going to trial, which is like 2 years later, and so on,
and he's making a spectacle of it.
Yeah, he's watched too much television. He was giving a speech yesterday about white supremacy or some. There was some problem with the judge. He was a traitor in some way. Maybe he's becoming a constitutional, like a Tea Party guy or something like that. Maybe he fell in with the wrong gang in prison. Now he's all about the Constitution and so on. He'll claim that she's not a citizen of the Corporation of the United States or something like that, or he's a citizen of America, not the United States, or that kind of thing.
That seems to be a very interesting distinction.
You have this Trump raid on Mar-a-Lago, you know, where they just, you know, scoop up all the documents and then they fight out in court back and forth as what can be released and what isn't and so on. And, you know, just to do nothing but keep him from running for president, you know, because they want him just to be so busy producing documents, which gets me to another Better Call Saul reality check. The when Howard wants to punish Kim. Well, by the way, I should have said right at the beginning, we're going to spoil the shit out of this. You know, I mean, it's this, you know, if you haven't...
Unmarked spoilers. I mean, if you haven't watched Better Call Saul... I mean, there have been some spoilers about the end of the Habsburg Empire in this show already.
That had nothing to do with
it. If you haven't seen that show, you know, sorry.
In the finale, there was that amazing flashback in black and white and silent film to the Sarajevo. And it was quite moving.
And they all sang Gott erhalte Franz den Kaiser together. Yes. My heart was broken in two. Actually, that it fared better than the Empire because that broke in like seven pieces.
Yeah, indeed. But moving ahead, spoilerlessly, when Howard wants to punish Kim, he condemns her to doing a document discovery. And so you
I think
see
it's doc review.
Doc review, yes, you are. Right. You are correct, sir. See, that's why you're the attorney, and I'm doing the doc review, which I can't even identify correctly. So, so there she is, and you know, and she's an associate of the firm, you know, and she's, you know, clawing her way up and all that. If they haven't fired her after the first year, we assume that she's on some kind of tenure track, and or partnership track, but. They've stuck her in the dark basement doing document review, so that's what associates do. Except as you were just saying, you know, lawyers don't want to show up in court, so they'll send an associate out to court. And again, unless they want to impress the client, who realizes he's paying the partner $500 an hour, but this associate is there in court, so they might show up for that reason. But mostly they spend doing these lousy jobs. It's boring.
Right. It's real donkey work. And at some point you realize that because I spent a lot of time as an associate, at some point you realize it's meaningless. Because what's going to happen is, you know, the big boss lawyers, the big fish is going to meet the big fish from the other firm, and maybe they meet the judge, or maybe they just meet among themselves. And they're going to decide the outcome of the case. There's a very interesting moment in, I believe, season 4 or 5, when Jimmy is essentially shaking the big banker guy, you know, the fat guy,
yeah.
Kevin Wachtel, right? The good old boy.
Yes.
He's trying to extract money out of him. It's under the pretext of protecting the rights of this one guy who doesn't want to sell his house. Or some indigenous lady who took a picture at one point. But Kevin Wachtel, because he's a businessman, he's not a lawyer, he sees through it. And he just says, this is a shakedown, right? So he meets with Jimmy, decides on a dollar figure so that, you know, this guy never shows up in his life again, and just pays the guy, which is a much more direct way of handling things, right? So I'm going to pay you $100 to go away. If only we could do that with our friends. Now, of course, you and I can reminisce about what a great show it was for a long time. But how is it so relevant to us as, because, you know, we are engaged in white nationalism. And something really struck me when I was watching this show. Now, you know, I've never practiced in America, but I do have some idea about the demographics of lawyers in America, the demographics of bankers in America. The only, let's call it, appropriate demographic representation was Rich Schweikart, right? The big guy of the other firm, the opposing counsel in the Sandpiper Crossing case.
Yeah, it kind of looks like Ron Silver.
Exactly, right. or who does he remind me of? A Jewish Al Pacino. So yeah. Al Pacino in Merchant of Venice.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, there's this old
Or Adam Sandler in that Jeweler movie that he did a couple years ago. What was it called? Can't think. Uncut Gems?
I don't know. I don't watch Adam Sandler movies.
It was reviewed on Countercurrents. It was a big deal because it was so incredibly Jewy. But that's
every Adam Sandler Jewy movie.
Well, this was a serious movie, though. This was his serious breakout sort of thing and so on. So he wasn't doing like the Adam Sandler routines, right? He was doing a Jew. He was doing a Jew. And he had the beard and the big nose. And he was
mask off Judaism?
Yeah, it was mask off. Mask off.
Mask off Judy. I don't know. I always found annoying person, right?
Oh, yeah.
I see Adam Sandler in a movie, I turn it off. I want the 5 seconds of my life back, which I spent.
At least in this movie, he gets it in the end. So there is justice. Yeah.
But, he gets put in a gas chamber.
Not a gas chamber, but he's dead. He's dead. He's a dead boy.
Okay.
Violently dead.
So, I see in the chat people are saying that Schweikart's actor is mixed Greek and Jewish. Just imagine how stingy that guy is. right.
Let's talk a bit about that. But before doing that, let me just throw out another bit of knowledge, another true fact that podcast listeners can learn from here. I only noticed this last night as I was looking at a video on YouTube that was Saul Goodman's first appearance, which I've seen before many, many times. But this was the first time I noticed, you know, he goes in, he's defending Badger. And so he stumbles in and he has some funny lines with the cop. And he's shuffling through his papers. And maybe you've been in this situation. So he's shuffling his papers. He doesn't really know this guy anything about this guy. He has to look at his file to find out. So he pulls out the file and says, "So, public masturbation. You know, I never got that. What's the appeal? I mean, why don't you just sit at home with the big screen TV like the rest of us and so on?" And Badger says, no, that's not me. I'm the guy selling meth, allegedly. And Saul shuffles his papers around a bit more and says, he says, simple transpositional error. Some whiteout will take care of that. I never noticed before, but that's what he does to his brother, Chuck.
Yep.
He did that to Chuck years before. And now it just sort of like comes up as his excuse. Oh, somebody must have done a transposition. I'll fix that with whiteout. Like, how often has he done this kind of thing?
Happens more often than you think.
This
is why... they don't teach you in law school, they don't prepare you for when you're an associate. Someone's going to walk into your office and you're going to have the wrong case file.
Right.
And you're not going to realize it until he actually starts talking about his case. And then you start remembering the details of the case and you realize, okay, that's not the guy, but I don't remember his name. The thing I have inside, and you have to find a way out of that.
Back slowly out of the room.
you get your associates or your interns to bring you the real file. You chew them out privately after that because it cannot possibly be your fault.
Oh, of course.
That would imply a failure of leadership, and you are, of course, the perfect and immaculate leader.
Exactly.
But it's taught, but I've learned to be... to have like a complete stony poker face when people are telling me. And another thing you learn is that most people, they don't know how to read the co-conversationalist. They come in, they start talking, and they start talking mostly with themselves. Mm-hmm. Most of the time when people are talking, at least in the context of a client coming to see an attorney, what people do is they speak at you, but really to themselves. They're trying to convince themselves that, yeah, I'm in the right. Yeah, we're going to win this. Yeah, I got the best attorney ever. Yeah, the other guy, and especially if it's gotten personal, and in many cases it gets personal because it's these people's lives most of the time. It's, And you learn to just nod, smile, be very polite at it. And it does happen. You do get the wrong case file sometimes, and you got no idea what's going on with this guy because, hey, maybe it's not even your case. Maybe the guys at the archives, they got something wrong.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. We've been getting donations all evening, and I have not been acknowledging them. We have 14 lendments from Slog. I love that number 14. It's almost as if it's one half of a conceptual whole we have yet to see completed this show. However, let's move on. We have another Diamond from Slag over on the live, and he says, bless the mods, and he does the horn thing, which is a universal sign for enjoying heavy metal, except in Italy, in which case it represents being horny, I believe. Yeah. I think. Or maybe it was Satanism. I forget. Yeah. Maybe those two is the same thing in Italy. That's about really just someone walks in and you have no idea.
Well, this leads to another important point about the show. And I don't know what legal education is like in Europe. I suspect it's vastly better than in America because we have this bullshit Socratic method nonsense. And basically, you spend a year suffering through that, which basically just trains you to anticipate what answer the professor wants. And then the next 2 years of law school, you don't do anything. You just sit in the back of the room if you show up at all. I don't know how this works. I've never been to law school, but this is what I universally hear, that you spend 2 years doing nothing. And then you graduate and you have to take a bar exam because they can't let you practice law because you know shit. So miraculously, they have these bar review courses, and in like 6 weeks, you can actually learn the law. So God forbid you should just take a bar course and then pass the bar and become an attorney. No, you have to spend 3 years. So one point is, so Saul's got his correspondence school degree from the Law School of the University of American Samoa.
Go land crabs.
Go land crabs, yes. And and he fails the bar exam twice. And this is New Mexico. I mean, no knock on New Mexico, but I mean, it's not California, which has famously the hardest bar exam in D.C. But it's New Mexico. You know, I mean, mostly you're learning, you know, state law. And there's not really that much state law in Mexico. It's probably geared towards land use law and oil and stuff, and maybe drugs, I guess. But that's the state law that you need for the bar exam. And then the federal law is just rote stuff. But here's the point, which is why you have to be licensed to practice in different states, because this obviously state law is different. But, you know, my impression is in Europe, John Mortimer, who wrote the Rumpole of the Bailey books, was interviewed once, and he said that, in England, it's the same sort of nonsense, right? You go to Oxford, maybe, and you study law or legal history or something, and then you have dinner for many evenings at these inns of court. It's all this medieval bullshit, and that's where you actually learn the practice. And he said, when I graduated from Oxford, the only law I knew was how to adopt a senator and grant manumission to a slave. Because it was all basically Roman law, which made sense as a foundational course, but you had no idea how to practice actual English law. So here's my point. The irony is, so Chuck, who went to, I think, Georgetown, and is supposed to be the greatest lawyer in the world or something like that, is absolutely personally insulted that Jimmy would practice law. To say nothing and want to practice law in his very law firm, Hamlin, Hanlon, McGill. I didn't spend all that time at Georgetown, a correspondence course, American Samoa, and so on. But the fact is, Chuck, he passed the bar exam. He took it three times, but so did John F. Kennedy Jr. And he became a district attorney in New York, right?
There is a psychology of these people who are like Chuck, because we forget that Chuck is not only a hotshot attorney, he's also he comes from humble origins, right? Just like Saul, but
just like Saul, same as Saul,
right?
Well, yes, but he's,
but he has
he took the good kid path, you know. He right. You know, like Nicholson says in The Departed, you know, when we it used to be they told us we could be priests or criminals or something like that, you know, or cops or criminals.
Right, and, you know, the Irish joke about the three brothers O'Brien, Patrick the cop, Jacob the criminal, and Michael the priest.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, Saul, of course, obviously took the criminal path, and Chuck is the good one. But here's the thing. Saul is qualified to practice law in New Mexico. I'm sorry, Chuck, he's qualified to practice law. He's just, and that's what insults Chuck. He's just as qualified as Chuck in the eyes of the law. Either of them can practice. Some guy from Harvard who lands in New Mexico can't practice unless he gets waived into the court. It's a formality, but nevertheless, theoretically, he can't practice because he's not licensed in New Mexico. Jimmy is, right? He's just as qualified as Chuck. So you have to ask yourself, what did Chuck learn in Georgetown? It's all just like this Ivy League. I know Georgetown's not Ivy League, but it's a high-level law school because it's in Washington, D.C. That's where Clinton went for his undergrad. Then he went to Yale, which is a real idea. But so Clinton goes to Yale, and where does he go back to practice? Arkansas. Why does a Yale grad go to Arkansas to practice? Answer is obvious. Not he's homesick. The answer is because it's a corrupt state. So we have to ask ourselves this question, two questions. One general sort of question, like, what's Chuck getting out of his Georgetown degree? It's all a bunch of, you know, schmoozing and who you know and that sort of stuff. That doesn't make you a better lawyer. But here's the thing. If he's such a great lawyer, why is he in New Mexico? Not to knock New Mexico, but seriously, why would a genius lawyer, the greatest legal mind of our time, why is he practicing in New Mexico? It's never explained.
The answer is
there. It's never explained. It's never explained. If somebody out there knows the answer, I'd welcome it. It's never explained. No one ever. Everyone just takes it for granted. Oh, Chuck's a genius. Chuck's a legal genius. He's the greatest lawyer around. How ironic! His brother is a con man, but he's the greatest lawyer. Why is he practicing in New Mexico? And there's no background to him. There's nothing like he used to be an ambassador, or he used to be a senator, or he was in Chicago or New York, and then he decided to move to New Mexico. No, there's no explanation for it.
That's the other thing, right? Both of them are from Chicago. Well, from Cicero, Illinois.
Cicero, right. Illinois.
Cicero. It's if it makes more sense to practice in Illinois, in Chicago, if you are this hotshot Georgetown guy, that's something I never really thought about. It could be, I got this, you know, because I studied at the most prestigious university in Macedonia, which considering we only have three, is not. Well,
the tallest building in Cleveland, yes, that's
right, right, right. Or, yeah. Or you know, the Irishman who has shagged the fewest sheep. It's, or is that the Welsh? I keep forgetting. It's nothing. It's right. But you used to get these people who come from humble beginnings, right? From humble origins, and they're really smart, like smarter than me. And they would study, and they would keep their nose to the grindstone, and they would have like a very, very high grade averages. It's like your GPAs, but they're different. And I just cruised through college. I drank and partied and I was not a good student, but I have a good deal of natural intelligence. I can understand things just from reading them once. I don't even have to read all that deeply. I can just skim. I'm very charismatic when I turn on the charm.
What do you
my
want
father
to?
Is a judge.
So
I come from privilege, not exactly from money, but I come from privilege. And I had a job right out the gate, and I was actually good at it because, as it turns out, and they don't teach you this in law school, being a lawyer is mostly about handling people. It's about handling clients, and it's not so much about handling the judge, it's about handling the doorman, right? The security guys at the court, the the people who can get you in through the back doors into the institutions. And since most of them get treated by like crap by people who think they're better than them, you know, that Seinfeld episode where Jerry substitutes for the doorman, would you believe it or not, people really do treat doormen like that.
Yeah.
Receptionists, secretaries, cleaning ladies, they really treat them like that. So if you're nice to the lady at the counter in the court or the guy who frisks everyone so they don't bring any weapons, they'll give you the back door to every institution. And if you just waltz up to some of these bureaucrats, it's a little life hack for you people. You waltz up to them and you pretend to be a little stupid, like slightly stupider than they are, like slightly less intelligent than they are. They're going to tell you everything you need to do to get the job done just to feel smart.
Right.
That's the kind of access bribery doesn't get you.
Well, there's
not another, that I would ever engage in bribery, but
there's
but the thing
life
is,
hack, you audience out there, it's a life hack. You're getting some good information here, so keep like, those
pretend to be stupid. Yeah. Bureaucrats are incredibly insecure. They like to feel smart. They like to feel smarter than lawyers, in particular, right? For some strange reason, and you
it's
just
easy to do.
You go in, you look mildly disoriented, but keep on maximum politeness, and they'll just do everything for you because they want
to. Sure,
feel
I think
smart.
We see Kim do that, for instance, on one occasion when she's in, so that she can, you know, commit a con, of course, but but to when they fool around with the. I don't know what they're called, like those big books of plans that the zoning.
Yeah, I think it's a zoning commission lady.
Yeah, yeah. So she kind of fools her, and she's got some line. I forget how it works, but I think Jimmy's involved, and he comes in and spills some coffee or something.
She pretends like she does not appeal to the lady's insecurity. She appeals to her good nature, like she pretends to have be a single mom who's being helped by
That's right, and she has like the child in the car, and so or something like that. That's supposed to be what's drawing her out. Well, see, she came to that, but this gets to the second prong of what I was saying about Chuck and Jimmy. So Jimmy's just as licensable as Chuck, but the irony is that Jimmy already knows what you've been talking about. He already knows how to work with people. He's a con man, of course, but nevertheless, he knows how to work people. And of course, he spent all that time in the law firm at the low level, you know. So he probably picked up a lot of information. I mean, after all, you know, I was working in the library. It's like a higher sort of level. It's interesting when the moment he decides to become an attorney, because he sees Chuck being congratulated by all those people, he turns around and marches to the law library, opens it, there's a sign on saying law library, and he opens it up, and it's the old time law library, you know, with books everywhere, right? It's all computerized now, but you know, they all the books there. And that's a nice moment. But but my point is, he already has the people skills. He already has the hack skills. So all he really needed was to pick up some stuff like you were saying, you know, read it a couple times and you know it. He's probably able to do that, although he didn't do all that well at the bar exam. But nevertheless,
the book smarts I've learned in many aspects of life, not just the law, the book smarts are overrated. Because
that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
You can have people to read things for you and look things up for you. You know, once you get to the big times, and if you can charm your way past the introductory stages, right, you can just snap your fingers and people will read the case files for you and summarize. Yeah. Although, you know, also a skill, this ability to scan a document and within 5 seconds extract all of the relevant information. Because there's a lot of bullshit in document production, but sometimes there's genuine info in it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you know, again, I don't know how law works in Europe, but the case with this case method in the U.S., where you're relying on precedent and so on, there's all these volumes of cases. And I once was walking behind a guy who was showing his girlfriend the library, and I'm not spying on them, but I was doing my job, you know, and I happened to be walking behind them, and she looked around and she said, "And you had to read all these books?" Well, of course not, I chuckled to myself, because most of these books, certainly the case books, first of all, you don't have to read them all because many of them are just irrelevant to anything you need to do. But the point is, they're printed by a commercial publisher, West, and they add headnotes. So you're really just reviewing the headnotes. Of course, that's very dangerous because you don't know if the headnote's accurate, you know, blah, blah, blah. But what you do is you tell your associate, you know, you're a partner, you scan the headnotes on the computer. You figure out what cases you need to look at. Then you tell the first-year associate to go to the library to see me and pull all those books off the shelf and photocopy. This is what I used to do before computers were really standardized. There were partners, because they could do anything they wanted, who didn't even want photocopies. They would send the associate and have him bookmark the actual books and put them on a big cart and take them to the guy. Right? He didn't even want photocopies. That's how old school this guy was. But basically, you know, you send the associate there to read the case to make sure it says what you think it says according to the headnotes that you scan. So, yeah, you're the high-level guy scanning stuff, and then you have your associate out there like Kim sitting in the dark room trying to figure this stuff out. So the people skill is really what you need. Or at least the ability to be, you know, Jimmy not only has people skills, he also has the ability to manipulate documents, like with the whiteout business and all that other stuff. He knows that kind of stuff, probably because he was working in the mailroom. And he's better than Chuck. He combines both the legal knowledge and the people skills. He could probably, and he does, he defeats Chuck on several occasions. Sometimes dishonestly, of course, but nevertheless, he's able. He knows the law. I don't think there's ever an instance where Saul is actually wrong on a legal point, right? He's always coming up with something. So he knows the law, but he also knows how to. Well, for instance, you were talking about it very early in the show, first season. So we see him bringing cupcakes or something to the woman who hands out the public defender assignment. See, that's exactly what you're talking about. You just treat people nicely. Interestingly, he eventually starts not treating nicely one of those people, namely Mike. He has like a little war with Mike going back and forth. So it's interesting that becomes an exception.
I don't think he ever goes to war with Mike.
It was a comical war. You know, he's like, you know.
When Mike is working the troll booth, right?
Yeah, exactly. The troll
he's booth. Insulting him, which is a very bad idea.
which is
a bad idea. I mean, it's just bad manners, I think, to insult service personnel as such, right? You do not have the right to insult a waiter, regardless of his ability to spit in your food. But it is, it was very stupid. I mean, we got to understand that Jimmy also comes from humble beginnings, and him being a lawyer, I guess he wants to flex status on Mike because he sees him as inflexible, because he sees him as, oh, now you're busting my boss for these stickers, right?
Well, that's a good point because partly it's because Jimmy still doesn't have a lot of money, so he resents having to pay for the parking, even though he was only in there for 2 minutes or something. And so there's that behind it. So yeah, he doesn't want to pay this guy. It's like the scene in Fargo, you know, you're a big shot now. Huh? Here's your fucking dollar, you know. That guy has no excuse, of course. But you know, but Jimmy is, we know he feels strapped for cash, so he's kind of annoyed about that. There was another angle to that I was thinking of, but I've forgotten it, so we can. Make him move on. Well, no, I was going to say
it is also a way of de-stressing. We know from Blackadder that how the great chain of being goes. The prince abuses the butler abuses the kicks the cat pounces on the mouse, and the mouse bites Baldrick on the behind. The great chain of abuse goes there. So I guess that Saul is looking for someone to victimize. There's a nasty streak to him.
But on another level, the irony of it for us in the audience is that Mike, at this point, is about to become a stone cold killer. I mean, he's already killed the two cops that he blames for his son's death, or actually did cause his son's death. And, you know, in audience morality, that makes him okay. You know, right? In theory, we don't want cops like that on the force. But as, you know, as viewers, we think, oh, yeah, he got the guys and got his son. It's great. But he's going to become an enforcer for Gus. So he's going to become a stone cold killer. Basically, after he kills Heinrich or whatever the German guy's name is.
Yeah. And,
but at the moment, Mike, even when he's doing that stuff, Mike's got his own morality. See, Mike is just like Chuck. He's got a morality, and he's enforcing it on Jimmy. So I think Jimmy also resents him as a kind of, you know, low-level Chuck. You know, it's bad enough I got to take shit from Chuck. Now I got this troll guy, you know, giving me the morality lectures as well. See, everybody thinks Jimmy's a bad guy. Well, here's a spoiler for you. He is a bad guy. Of course, people with morality dislike Jimmy because he is a bad guy. He's the guy, to put this in the lawyer context, he's the guy that people think lawyers are. You know, it's like, what, you know, if you don't like lawyers, this is because you have this guy in mind. That's why those commercials were so funny right from the start, because we've all seen those commercials, at least in America, with the two-bit lawyers. And that's exactly what Jimmy is. He'll always be, even though I've been lauding him a bit here, you know, saying, you know, he's smart enough to be a lawyer and he's got the people skills, but he's fundamentally bad. He's a bad guy. And that's the thing that's behind all of this. Chuck is right when he tells Jimmy, you'll never change and you should just stop with the remorse because it doesn't mean anything. You know, as Schopenhauer would say, you know, our character doesn't change. You know, Jimmy was bad from the beginning. Everything that leads up to whatever he does, you know, seeing the con man con his father when he was a kid, and all this other stuff, it's only like an approximate cause. It's something random that happens in the environment that sets him off. But he wouldn't be set off like that if he wasn't bad from the beginning. You know, there was no way to stop him. In fact, the more he tries to be a good guy, the more people he harms, which again is Chuck's point. You know, stop trying to be a good guy. You know, he gives him the Hannibal Lecter lecture from Manhunter. You know, you think you'd be a lot easier. This is Hannibal Lecter speaking. You know, your life would be a lot easier for you if you just accepted it. We don't choose the way we are. Our character is assigned to us like our pancreas. You know, just go with it. You know, you have the ability to see into the mind of serial killers and it freaks you out. Just go with it. Enjoy yourself.
We can accept it's something it's one of the deeper red pills, you could say, of being a dissident. We know about IQ and genetic heritability, that's some ungodly percentage heritable. So you're basically doomed to have the same IQ for your entire life. And the only thing you can really do is halt the decline that comes with age. Well, not even halt, but slow the decline that comes with age by exercising, of all things. Right. But we tend to underestimate the degree to which our character is genetically determined as well. I guess it's a white people thing because we believe in morality and we believe that, oh, people choose to be good, which, I mean, maybe they choose to obey the law rather than be criminals. And morality is a kind of law. It's less stringently enforced. But ultimately, I think people are doomed to be what they were born to be. It's one of my most controversial, I would say, positions that everyone's saying, oh, at some point, conservatives or white people or young men or old men, they're going to have enough and they're going to rise up and rah, rah. No, they're not going to rise up. These are people who've been taking shit for 200 years and they've been saying thank you for their daily bowl of shit, and they're going to keep saying thank you. You know who's going to rise up? you're not going to like the answer, so I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to discourage fundraising.
Okay, yes. But, yeah. Nevertheless, though, this is, I think, maybe the core dissident right kind of theme in the show itself, is that people don't change. So we're going to sit back. So we already know where Saul winds up. That's the joke here, you know, because we do know where Saul winds up. So any attempt he makes to be good or at people to help him, we know it's futile anyway, because we've seen the end. So so that's the dissonant right angle of it. I made a note here that which I think is important, but I can't recall why what the context is. But I think if you look at what Saul does, he harms more people when he tries to be good. I'm not sure if I what I'm thinking about when I wrote that down, but it occurred to me as I was watching an episode recap, is that there's all kinds of collateral damage that Saul causes, usually when he tries to be good. It's sort of like what the lesson that Mike learns about no half measures.
Yeah.
You know, if you need to kill somebody, just kill him. You know, don't try to work out some Rube Goldberg thing that'll, you know, land him in prison instead. You know, he should have killed Tuco instead of putting him in prison and then having him get out later. You know,
yeah, that would have just removed so much, just moving parts from the calculus of the show. But I guess it's supposed to demonstrate to us how Mike learned the lesson about half measures, exactly, which he repeats to Walter White on Breaking Bad.
And so does Saul in his first appearance when he says, "Why don't you just kill what's his name? Gopher? What's his name? Hamster? What's the guy?
Badger.
Name? Badger." Right. Why don't you just kill Badger? And Walt is all for it, by the way. It's Pinkman who because he's his friend. But no half measures. You know, don't attack the lawyer. You attack the guy. You don't attack the lawyer in hopes that the guy will do some magic in court that will take care of your problem. Although, in fact, Saul does figure out a way to do it.
Well, I don't think that Walt and Jesse retaining the services of a lawyer is a half measure. I think that Jesse said it in the Better Call Saul episode that if you're running a criminal enterprise, guys are going to get, quote-unquote, pinched. You need to have a guy on retainer to unpinch them or to minimize damage to the broader a criminal organization, and that's part of the cost of doing business. I'm just trying to approach this from a managerial standpoint, be rational about it. I guess killing guys is a way, but that way, you know, a drug dealer who's your employee, essentially, he reasons that, well, if I get pinched, which happens, you know, shit happens, these guys are going to whack me, so I'm just going to not work. So you're out of personnel for your organization. That's a problem. See, the being good, being forthright and fair-minded and fair to your employees is actually not just something stupid saps do. It's good business practice.
The further irony is that Walt will eventually be guilty in some way, again, partially legally, and also in other instances, in sort of like what you might call a viewer morality, he's going to be guilty of the deaths of hundreds of people. You know, just for his own selfish reasons, for his own pride, really, which is what Mike tells him just before he gets killed by Walt, for daring to say you fucked everything up because of your goddamn pride. Well, there you go. And the same thing with Jimmy. It's pride. Well, actually, no, it's Chuck. It's Chuck whose pride is his downfall. But Walt, you know, in that second or third episode where they meet Saul, you know, Walt is trying not to kill Badger or have Badger get killed. And, you know, eventually he's going to be killing hundreds of people. You know, he caused two airlines to collide, for Christ's sake.
Well, that was really more tenuous.
It was a little, the
airliner collision was really on the nose. But if you're looking at it from we're talking about Breaking Bad now.
That happened because he let Jane die. So first of all,
I really wouldn't look at it through a moralistic standpoint. I see it more like You know, the butterfly effect. Oh, so you flipped her over and she vomited into her mouth because she was high on drugs and, you know, tripping out on heroin or whatever. And that caused her father to grieve. And then because he's such a hard ass, he came back into work while he was grieving. So the two airliners collided and that killed whatever. No, it's just so much remote. What if I had been... If I am rude to someone on the street and he's an air traffic controller, am I to blame? But he cut me off on the freeway. Am I to blame when he slams an airplane into a building? It's really a stretch over there.
Well, I know it's not legally the case, and maybe not even morally the case. But what I'm talking about is viewer morality. You know, I mean, you're supposed to not like this guy because of bad things that happen all around it. You know, it's like what your parents would tell you. Don't associate it with that guy. Bad things happen. doesn't matter what the precise causality is. You don't say, well, Mom, can you show me the causal connection that leads to all these? No. All I know is people around him die. They go to prison. They get chopped up. They get dissolved in bathtubs of hydrochloric acid. You know, don't be around him. It's just keep away from him. There's something bad going on with this guy, which also reminds me of another thing. At some point, Walt tells Jesse, I let Jane die. I think that's in the Ozymandias episode.
Yep.
There's two big secrets that go to someone's grave in Better Call Saul. Is that Chuck never tells Jimmy that their mother, with her dying breath, was calling out for him. He spitefully never tells her that and just holds it against Jimmy. And Jimmy never tells Howard that, well, again, this is what you were just talking about, that Howard really isn't responsible for Chuck's death. Now, you could say in regards to what you were just saying, neither of them is responsible. I mean, Chuck committed suicide, but he was driven to it. Or was he? Wasn't it just his pride that made him not accept what Jimmy did? But what Jimmy did was bad anyway. See? So, and the same thing with the Howard thing. I mean, Howard blames himself for Chuck's death because he forced him out of the firm, you know, took away his self-image and says, well, that's why he killed himself. Jimmy knows that's not true, but he never tells Howard because he just enjoys watching Howard suffer. And eventually he'll again, did he pull the trigger on Howard? No, it was Lala. But is Howard there because of Jimmy's shenanigans? Yes. Is Lalo there because of Jimmy's shenanigans? Yes. Lalo didn't know who this guy was. He just shot him because he's a psychopath and didn't want to witness. Right? He didn't know who Howard was. He just shot him. Oh, yeah, I want to talk to these guys. So you're in the way. Bang. Then he sits down and says, let's talk. Right? So in all those circumstances, no, there's no direct causal connection. There's really perhaps no morality, but people do bad things and bad things happen around them. And you should stay away from them. That's why Kim, ultimately decides that she can't be around Jimmy.
Well, because also I think she realizes that she enjoys being bad.
Exactly.
It's something that people are not prepared to hear about themselves, that they enjoy, that they have a sadistic streak, right? Which, as I grow older, I learn that, yeah, there is a sadism to me, which I don't like, but it is there, and it's going to keep on being there. And the best I can really do is either control it or put it towards something I enjoy, something that's quote unquote good, right?
Yeah.
And Kim, I think she chooses to suppress it completely by living a completely uninteresting life. Oh, Nacho has come. Lalo has come for Mr. O'Meara. It is unfortunate, really. Before you are ultimately shot in the head, James, I want to fess up to the fact that I started the rumor that you are Bronze Age pervert. That's a joke there.
I can neither confirm nor deny that.
Yeah, I know you're not him. Bronze Age pervert, he's different. My point is really people have darkness in them, which they cannot really accept. And they cannot fully control ever, so they run from it. And this is why I think ultimately Kim runs from it, whereas Jimmy says, fuck it, I'm the bad guy. Embraces his darkness. Walt does it ultimately, but is shot for his trouble. And that's maybe a hidden lesson of Better Call Saul. Now, of course, because we are a right-wing, white identitarian, identitarian as such podcast, we need to address the elephant in the room, the ethnic composition of the cast. Now, we have the two mix. We have Chuck and Jimmy, right? Charles and James McGill. Those are royal names. Those are Stuart names.
Stuart names.
Someone is a secret Jacobite over there.
Uh-huh. And, naming your son Jimmy.
Hmm?
Hence naming your son Jimmy.
Hence naming your sons James and Charles.
Yes. Right?
Is that an accident? I don't think not. Right. So we have established, but they're Irish, right? McGill, and very proud. So, well,
fellow potato eaters. Fellow potato eaters. Yes. I've never heard that expression before or since. I think they just made it up.
I think it's like Red Sea Pedestrian, which I think Graham Chapman made up for Life of Brian. I had never heard Red Sea Pedestrian before or after.
Exactly.
Well, but it is interesting. And you have them essentially insinuating themselves into the firm of Howard Hamlin. Now, my first reaction when I started watching Better Call Saul all those years ago was, wow, he's literally me, referring to Jimmy McGill. But as time went on and I came to grips with what I really am, I realized I'm not Jimmy McGill. I'm Howard Hamlin. I fell ass backwards into privilege and somehow managed to blow it all away. But then, that's a story for another way, another day.
Well,
my point is basically, isn't this the classic story of New America, Ellis Island America, displacing blonde, blue-eyed WASP America? Because Hamlin, he doesn't look like what I imagine American lawyers are. But I think they deliberately selected the author to be this classic Chad.
Lawyers used to look like that. Good, you know, expensive lawyers used to look like that.
Mm.
That gets into all this stuff. And by the way, ironically, this is going on in New Mexico, which is not really an Anglo heartland. I think it's the only state that has Spanish, has always had Spanish as its second language, officially. And its capital is Las Cruces. And as somebody pointed out, when Mexicans come to America, you think they would go to New Mexico, but they actually go to anywhere else because New Mexico, as its name implies, is too much like Mexico. It's a shithole. But you have this hyper Anglo guy, this Hamlin. But let's back up a little bit. There used to be lawyers like that. There used to be the expression Philadelphia lawyer. A WASP, member of the WASP elite, and working with members of the WASP elite, big clients, fortunes, either companies or, people who inherited their money, mainline, Philadelphia, that sort of thing, Episcopalians, And the expression you still hear it, although people don't understand it anymore, a white shoe lawyer, because they used to wear white shoes, because they could afford to throw them away when they got scuffed. And so they wore white shoes. It was like, fuck you, It's like, like rich Southern plantation guys would wear white suits. You know how hard it is to clean one of those white linen suits? I mean, you have to actually disassemble it and wash each part separately. It's very expensive. You need slaves to handle all that. They used to have special laundries in Washington, D.C. to handle all those Southern senators with their white suits. Anyway, the point is, the legal establishment, like the social establishment, it used to be run by WASPs. And that also excluded the Irish. So you have an interesting thing to develop, because we think of lawyers as being Jews these days, frankly. I worked for a law firm in New York that was the first major Jewish-owned and operated law firm from back in the 1920s. And it was created because, on the one hand, smart Jewish lawyers couldn't get hired by Wall Street firms because they wouldn't hire them. Didn't want Jews. They didn't want Jews as partners, and their clients didn't want to work with Jews. So what can you do? So they started. But the genius of this guy was to realize, he'll remain nameless for now, but was to realize there's a lot of rich fucking Jews in this town, right? His first client was Bloomingdale's, right? White shoe firms didn't want Bloomingdale's, even though it was immensely rich, because they're Jews. We don't work with Jews. I don't care how much money you have. We're not working with Jews. They didn't want to work with Jews, and their other clients would leave them. They knew it. So
with Jews, you lose.
With Jews, you lose, except if you're a Jew. This was that they cornered the market on rich Jews. So they became a huge law firm. They're one of the top 10 law firms still. And they got all the Jewish lawyers in the days when the white shoe firms wouldn't hire Jewish lawyers. They also got Irish lawyers because the white shoe firms wouldn't hire Irish lawyers either. So you had an actual, so this is not a sociological stereotype. There was an actual firm in New York, which I worked for, that was at least in its origins. Of course, things have obviously loosened up. In fact, the firm was now run by, that doesn't matter to them, but there are other firms even run by Jews now. But for the longest of times, this was a place that had cornered the market on smart Jews and smart mix, came from law school. This was a time when Mario Cuomo couldn't get a job in New York. Mario Cuomo couldn't get a job on Wall Street because he was a WOP, right? So it used to be a real thing. Now, of course, it isn't. But from the point of view of Better Call Saul, that's right from the very first time we meet Saul. He gives his potato eater thing, but I pretend to be a Jew because the people want to hire a pipe-hitting member of the tribe. I thought, I know this guy. I am this guy. These are the people I work with, at least in terms of heritage, you know.
He's far scuzzier. In the first episode of first season, Betsy Kettleman, the what's her name, real true crime with Ned and Maude Flanders. She says to him, "You're the kind of lawyer guilty people hire."
Exactly.
Right? So you're the scuzzy, scummy lawyer who's going to take all of the Cohens and the Lanskys and the Lucianos as his clients. You're not like that nice Howard Hamlin who looks respectable, yeah. Who's got he's blonde and blue-eyed. He's got that granite jaw and the knit tie, which I admit I was partial to knit ties as well when I was part of practicing. And that was before I ever saw Better Call Saul. Right. Bit of a peacock there.
Well, this is, go ahead.
No, it's really interesting to me. And of course, you showcase, this is something that Mark Weber will often talk about. The weak point of the WASPs is that they did not really ultimately respect kin. They respected merit, right? So by letting in the good Mick, right, the good Irish lawyer, which is Chuck, you also open the door to certain Jimmy. It's like a black family moves into the neighborhood.
Exactly. Or as somebody said, like on you know Uns or something like that. You know, the problem is that the nice computer scientist black guy who moved in next door that's intelligent and not a criminal and so on, he's got a cousin who's going to be coming over and casing the neighborhood. And starting some burglaries, right?
Which some people don't understand about why people say we talk about average IQs and crime rates and average this and average that. Yeah, there's exceptional black people. I've met some of them, right?
Yeah.
I've met some exceptional black people. I've met some some Jews. They're not scummy, but they have friends and they have families.
They got friends.
They have people of their ethnic group they're associated with, sometimes involuntarily, in a family.
Because especially the Jews, of course, are keen on ethnic networking still, right? Whereas the WASP, as you said, it sort of like abandoned that and said, well, we'll make more money, we'll be more successful if we have some of these smart Jews, even though they're Jews, but they'll help us. Or they'll bring in those Jew clients like Bloomingdale's and so on, right? Now, I've explored this. So in the context of this, I like what you were just saying about Chuck being like the thin end of the wedge, the camel's nose under the tent. And so functionally, Jimmy is already Saul Goodman, because that's the sequence, right? Howard Hamlin partners up with McGill, and then McGill brings in his brother, who turns out to be Adam Sandler or somebody like that, right? So that's exactly what's going on. That was the ethnic decline in the U.S. And as I say, it's interesting it's going on in New Mexico because it sort of parallels the immigration problems and so on. But here's the thing: I explored this in my book, End of an Era, Mad Men and the Ordeal of Civility, because what they did in Mad Men. See, I sort of read these two series against each other or alongside each other. What you saw in Mad Men was that they never addressed the Jewish issue. Except they did address it in exactly what I was talking about. They sort of wanted to get a Jewish department store client. This was straight out of my own background. I know exactly what they were talking about. They wanted to get a Jewish department store client. Because they had lots of money. They were looking for a new law firm, a new advertising agency, but the same thing. And there was a lot of problems. They asked Roger, who, by the way, is like Howard Hamlin. He's the son of the founder, and he has silver hair and nice suits and so on. So he's the Hamlin character. Asked Don, who's the Jimmy McGill character, because he has a criminal past, and he's under an assumed name. So he asked Don, do we hire any Jews around here? Because they want some Jews in the conference room, right? And Don says, not on my watch. But they eventually find one in the copy room or something like that, and they put a suit on him and have him there pretending to be one of the admin so that the Jewish client will feel comfortable. But other than that, they completely ignore the takeover of the advertising business by Jews to the extent that, just like with lawyers, we think of admin as being Jewish or sort of Jewy in general. And they handle
it. You see that in the show, right? You see, what's his name? Oh, I forget. Cliff Maine, the straight-laced, again, WASP lawyer from the other firm where they do the Sandpiper Crossing case. When they put in the ad for Sandpiper Crossing, and all these firms, they cannot come up with showmanship, which is something that our long-nosed friends actually do have. We have to take it off. We have to take off our hats to them. Jewish showmanship really is something. We've discussed carnies and the carny phenomenon here on the Writer's Block in a previous episode.
Indeed.
But if you look at what Saul accomplishes, and I think that Jimmy / Saul stands in for the Jewish-Irish takeover of America, if we're going being uncharitable.
Well, let me. This brings up a couple of interesting things, but let me just finish this one thought. That in Mad Men, they sort of cryptic it, they crypsis it. They come up with the firm of McCann Erickson. So you got an Irish name and a Scandinavian sort of name, and this is like a big giant conglomerate that's going to swallow up all their competitors. And throughout the entire series, that's always like a nemesis. And the firm is explicitly identified as being Irish and Catholic. Now, I don't know if that was ever true of McCann Erickson. Obviously, it seems to have originally been such a firm. But the idea that some Irish Catholic ad agency is dominating advertising is just surreal. But it works because the Irish are the sort of like the WASPy face of the Jew, right? So you have this kind of crypsis. So they can't talk about a big Jew firm, but they'll talk about a big Irish firm. See? And the same thing here, you know, people, you know, so what we find here is the same thing. We have Jimmy McGill, who's essentially the Jewish character. Now, you just mentioned something about ads, which is important. And getting all the way back to what I was saying before about Chuck, there's this whole thing throughout where Chuck sabotages Jimmy's career in the sense of not getting him into the firm. Well, there we see it, you know, who wants a Jew, right? So even though this is his brother and he's really Irish, but thematically he's the Jew, he's the intruder. Why don't they want him there? They want someone like Chuck, even though Chuck's Irish. Well, because Chuck went to Georgetown. Chuck is sophisticated. Chuck has got all the veneer. Jimmy isn't going to fit in. Jimmy thinks that they're going to give him an office because he brought them a big client, but they don't care. Right? The big client is a class action suit by a bunch of senior citizens. They got no money. They're going to be dead soon anyway. They're not a continuing client. It's a nice thing. They'll give them $25,000 and 25% of the settlement, but we're not going to make you a partner. Are you crazy? Are we going to give you an office here? People see you. Remember how Howard Clark flips out when Jimmy puts up the ad where he's pretending to be Howard? You know, he's wearing Howard's suit. He's got Howard's blue. He's got the Hamlin logo.
And Hamlindigo blue trademark.
Hamlindigo blue, exactly. So you can try to copyright it, but the Jew will always find the trick to get around it, you know. But anyway. And so
it's interesting because you hear it about, I was recently reading something on American Renaissance from Gregory Hood, and he's all about, oh, well, the Hispanics are not naturally conservative, but the white ones are. And I'm thinking, okay, what I'm seeing here is the Anglo, I think Gregory Hood is Anglo, could be Irish, I don't know.
Nick Hood, yes.
I don't know what his real name is. He's got like 1,000 nicknames and nom de plumes, but
yeah. like a certain tribe we know. Yeah.
He's got many names.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. But I can see those Anglo fucking wheels in your head turning. You're looking for ways to separate out. Well, hold on a second. Well, these are the good ones, and we want those, but these are the bad ones, and we don't want those. And we're going to find a way to qualify. And essentially, university education is the filter by which you separate out the good ones from the bad ones.
Exactly.
Right.
Notice where Jimmy is not. Jimmy just
which is to bring us back to the ascent of Jews in America. I think Mark Weber has mentioned this again. WASPs never expected the Jews to cheat, which that would not be sporting, right? Yeah. And now the Jews are facing a threat from the Chinese who are completely shameless about cheating. I mean, Jimmy, he's going to graduate from the University of American Samoa, and it's American Samoa, go Landkrabs, but he actually graduated. If it was a Chinese Saul Goodman, right, he would have just bought his a diploma.
Well,
I've seen the Chinese do it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just about to say that where does Jimmy get his education? University of American Samoa? I mean, America Samoa, you know? Just like in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, right, where Thompson is continually talking about a Samoan attorney who doesn't understand our white culture. Doesn't understand how you can succeed in this culture and so on. And he's making these jokes. And Oscar Zeta Acosta, the real attorney, speaking of attorneys, Oscar Zeta Acosta, who was the real attorney, was insulted by this. Because how can you tell people I'm a fucking 300-pound water-headed Samoan? Right? And the lawyers in New York couldn't understand why Oscar Acosta, the Chicano attorney, wanted to be identified in the book because they figured he'd be disbarred and who would give up their license to steal, right? So the New York lawyers couldn't understand why the Chicano lawyer was insulted for being called a Samoan. It would be better than being identified accurately because then you'd lose your license. I mean, you got the whole civility thing is going on there, right? And let me point out another thing. So say
what you will about Mexicans and Chicanos, right? There is an honor-based element to their culture, which sadly is not exactly present among the WASPs.
Anymore, at least. Yeah.
Anymore, right.
Well, I mean, those are the people Gregory Hood is talking about, probably. And theoretically, I mean, they were talking about the real Hispanics, you know, the Spanish people, you know. Cue the flamenco music and dignidad and the black clothing of the white ruffles and so on of the Spanish aristocrats and so on and Ricardo Montalban selling Chryslers with rich Corinthian leather and all that, you know, this, you know, Spanish dignity. Thomas Mann writes about that all the time in Magic Mountain. Spanish dignity.
Right. But the thing is, even these people, they have cousins who deal drugs and decapitate people with machetes. Because we see this in, again, the next racial element I want to address. And on Breaking Bad, you saw it. On Breaking Bad, you could almost say this is a story about the gentrification of crime.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you have these dumbass Mexican criminals, right? Or, well, half Mexican, half Japanese in Emilio Koyama's case. And they don't know what they're doing. And then you have Walter White with his super product, essentially, barging in, taking over the market with his white man's ego, which Mike so helpfully points out. And I thought, look, I don't believe it. He made a Mighty Whitey story in 2008, but, you know, because he sold it as a morally complex drama. Oh, he's actually a bad guy because he's taking over the drug trade. He somehow got away with it. Oh, and yeah, he added the neo-Nazi gang at the end as the bad guys.
Yeah. Well, here's getting back to what we were saying before, however, as well, gentrification of crime. What I was talking about before, you know, law firms that didn't want certain kinds of clients, no matter how rich they were. For example, Gus Fring, right? So, you know, Gus Fring, not the chicken entrepreneur, but the meth lord, that's where all the money is. No matter how much money he has, it's not the sort of client they would want. Of course, you know, because he's South American. I guess if he was an Anglo gangster, you know, like a Joseph Kennedy bootlegger, they might go with that. But anyway,
was Joseph Kennedy, really?
Well, but my point is, you know, you don't, these guys didn't want to have to deal with guys like Gus Fring just because they had lots of money, see? But Jimmy is perfectly willing to deal with them. So that's the kind of client he would bring in, as it were. So that's why they don't want guys like him.
Gus Fring is actually very good at flying under the radar. A better example is Lalo Salamanca.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
This is someone who actually signs up to be Jimmy McGill's client, and he says, you want to be a friend of the cartel, right? Yeah, so right. Your client, he's not asking you to do lawyer stuff. He's asking you to haul $7 million in cash across the desert, which Jimmy does. You know? Yeah. And these things, they count, like, I've done maybe not hauled bags of cash across the desert for clients, but I've done some pretty stupid things for clients. And they remember things like that, little gestures of personal.
They love that stuff. That gets back to the schmoozing part. I mean, that's the down and dirty stuff. But even earlier, we were talking about Jimmy's ability to schmooze people and so on, right? He's memorable, exactly. And they think he's a nice guy, and he's cooperative and so on. He's even willing to commit crimes. He's so amenable. He's so nice, right? But just to finish off a previous thought, you know, the thing is, you don't want this guy in your office. You don't want clients to see him. You don't want to have him around anyway, even though he brings in the big client. So Davis and Maine make the mistake of hiring Jimmy. And we know what happens, right? It's exactly what they would have predicted. Jimmy acts like an asshole, embarrasses clients, creates chaos, and they have to fire him. And he does it in such a way that he still keeps his signing bonus.
Right?
So this is exactly what Howard Hamlin, we know he was actually Chuck was sabotaging, but we know exactly what they were worried about. He's going to act like that. You piss him off for some reason, he'll get you. And indeed, he kills, well, he's responsible for Howard's death and Chuck's death because he had to get back at them. Just like Walter White, pride, right? He had to get his revenge on them in some petty way and cause their deaths ultimately. Right. That's the extreme. That's the dramatic extreme version. But the comical version is Davis in Maine. That's what they didn't want in their office. They didn't want those shenanigans. They didn't want a guy playing bagpipes. Now, Jimmy says, are you going to give me an office? No. Why? Well, frankly, because we think you'll play the bagpipes there. You know, if they, you know, we know what's going to happen in the future, but, you know, these people don't. But it turns out they were right. You know, you should never hire a guy like Jimmy because he's never going to change. He's always going to be an asshole. You know, it's interesting you talk about the Chinese cheating and so on. The Coen brothers movie, A Serious Man, which is a devastatingly satirical look at Jewish life.
I've seen it, yeah.
And you remember the Jewish math professor has, or teacher, I don't know if it's high school or college, but he has this ethical dilemma because the Chinese kid wants to buy a passing grade. And, you know, doesn't even see why there's a problem. What's the problem? Not enough money, or what? You know, what's the deal? You know, so that's exactly what's going on there. And, you know, of course, all the vulgar ads and things and so on. Right? You can see exactly why they didn't want this guy around. He's not Georgetown material. Even in New Mexico, he sticks out like a sore thumb.
He's not one of us. He does not fit in with our culture. And when they see you're not a good fit in the team, you're not a good fit in the corporate culture, it's exactly what they're trying to tell you. But somebody's got to be a friend of the cartel. Somebody's got to be an attorney. Because we, you know, like the West, the collective West, everyone in Western civilization, we have decided that it's okay to let in Mexicans and they run drugs and smuggle weapons and whatever. Someone's got to be their lawyer.
Well, you know, just to stir things up a little bit or play the...
And it's really, you know, it's the whole thing, right? I know you're going to go into a Brother Stair rant right now, but the whole ministering to the poor aspect is, I believe, it's a very easy way to tug at an audience's heartstrings.
No.
Which he does with the elders, right? The fact that he's actually helping these elders, which a lot of the big shot lawyers are ignoring, that's very interesting. That's maybe the path he could have taken.
He could have taken, except he stumbled on a scheme.
Right.
Except he was too good of a lawyer, and he discovered that the nursing home was up to shenanigans. Right.
Which I don't believe anyone else caught it, but the nursing home is called Sandpiper, right?
Yeah.
What does that mean? It means they're laying pipe in sand, right? Which means fucking old ladies. I'm sorry. This is a classy show.
That's a bit of a stretch, I think. There was an aspect of that. Sandpiper. You've completely thrown me off now. It's like...
This has got to come out in post-production.
I was going to play the devil's advocate amongst the dissident, right? You talk about welcoming Mexicans and things like that. And there's something to that. But, you know, getting back to the whole New Mexico business, you know, we stole that land in the first place, right? We made it part of the United States, right? 1848, the Mexican War, right? We took that land from Mexico. We didn't buy it from Russia. We didn't buy it from France. No, we stole it. Right? It was the first of our great, bullshit wars. And this is the war that drove Thoreau crazy. That's why he was put in prison, in jail overnight, because of some tax he wouldn't pay to support the Mexican War. It drove Emerson crazy. You know, this was the beginning of our imperial escapades. All the imperial stuff, the Spanish-American War, World War I, blah, 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 all this stuff started cascading after the Mexican War. Schopenhauer even wrote about it. Schopenhauer used that in the Mexican War as an example of how democratic republics invariably become totalitarian monsters. In 1848, he already foresaw what was happening. See, they stole this land from a peaceful neighbor. And they talk about democracy. Ha! So, you know, why are those people in what better question is, why are people in New Mexico in America? Why are people in Arizona in America? Why are people in California in America? Because we stole the land. So it's our problem. We started it.
Yeah, I mean, when you steal land, at least have the decency to commit ethnic cleansing.
That's a very good point, because that's what we did with the Indians. You know, that's what the Spanish didn't do in their colonies, because in their world, because they intermarried and so on with the people.
And people tell me that Catholicism is based. No, yeah. I've seen pictures from Mexico.
Or from another angle, William Burroughs, when he was living in Mexico, said that the Latin Americans had the good luck to be conquered by the white trash of Europe. His point being that the Spanish were no better than the Incas and so on, and they just mixed up with each other. Whereas the Puritans and the Anglos in the north went out and exterminated everyone, right? So instead we got these mestizos all through Latin America. And Burroughs thought it was a good thing, because, you know, it meant, you know, Mexico was an easygoing place where he said cops had no more authority than a bus driver.
Which is a mixed blessing. You know?
Well, for a junkie and criminal con man like Burroughs, yeah, it's a great place to hang out. Which gets me back to the con man angles. This is the essential point that both this show and Mad Men explore. The central truth about America and Americans is that everyone's a con man. Right. This has been true. All the great works of American literature are about con men. Melville, Poe wrote an essay on the art of diddling. Emerson, in a sense, it was being satirized by Melville with his confidence man, because Emerson was always talking about confidence and positive thinking. The Great Gatsby. A great book from the 40s, The Big Con, which is a history of con men. William Burroughs was a con man. Donald Draper, whose name sounds like duper, and Draper means hidden away, and Don means to put on a costume. Don Draper, the great duper, is an ad man, which is to say a con man. He's a criminal who's pretending to be an upright wasp. You find much the same thing in Better Call Saul. Jimmy's a con man. He's essentially a con man. He's all American. He's got the big Statue of Liberty balloon on top of his building. He's a true American, oddly enough. So, you know, you can call him a crypto Jew. You can call him an Irish intruder. You can say he's infiltrating the wasp hierarchy and so on, but were the wasps all that different from the point of view of being con men? I mean, the people Poe was writing about, Melville was writing about, were all wasps, I think.
They don't call him Perfidious Albion or the Eternal Angle.
Exactly. Yeah, thanks for adding that. Yeah, they don't call him Perfidious Albion for nothing, right? And isn't that what America does? It goes around the world talking about democracy and freedom and so on, and kills anyone who gets in our way. But just one to tie this off with essential point, or something I noticed. What a lot of these recaps about Saul say is the point where he really becomes Jimmy, where he really crosses the line, is when he sabotages Chuck's professional insurance. And that's the thing that leads Chuck to be ousted from the firm, that leads to his suicide. And that's after he humiliates Chuck in the bar hearing. So even after that, he still wants revenge. And as he's leaving that office, there's controversy about whether he had the plan in mind and that's why he went to the insurance agency, or it just occurred to him because she mistakes him for Chuck, and that puts the idea in his head. But when he leaves the office, and he's been crying and weeping and so on, and when he's in the office, he leaves the office and his face gradually composes itself. And just before he leaves the shot, he grins. And that's straight out of Poe. What is the last thing the diddler does at night? he grins, right? It's what it's what's called Duper's delight, right?
Right.
It's always, that's always the tell, that little grin that they have after they pulled a successful con. And that, of course, when Mad Men ends, the final shot, when Don is meditating at the California retreat, and suddenly he grins. That's the moment of the con man, and he comes up with the idea of the I'd like to teach the world to sing Coke commercial, and resurrects his career. In Once Upon a Time in America, when Robert De Niro is lying there in the opium den, at the end of the movie, he grins, and that's the freeze frame at the end. You know, Sergio Leone with the huge giant close up. It's a big grin on his face. That's the American. You know, Americans are always, Europeans always say Americans are always smiling all the time. They're always smiling. Well, some of them are smiling, but some of them are it's the duper's grin, right? They've got their con has succeeded. So
about the grin, I mean, there is of course the American sales style, which I suspect, because I saw it, I first noticed it as such a thing on Mormon girls who were harassing me about joining their strange religion. I thought to myself, well, knowing America, the preaching style came first and then it evolved into salesmanship, right? But you notice that, and junior salesmen, like people who are just starting out, like the Mormon youth they dispatch overseas, they make the mistake of front-loading the smile, and that always tips Europeans off that something's off. Yeah, why are you smiling? Why are you so happy? Why aren't you miserable like us?
Because God has a special plan for us.
What the hell could have you smell like smiling from ear to ear? And not a lot of people get hooked into the Mormon grift here in Europe. I suspect it's because, in Eastern Europe, at least, we distrust anything that's positive outlook towards life. We know better. There's an arrogance to that as well, that, yeah, life is bad, it's just going to get better, but we have learned to live. It is arrogant. An interesting ethnic dimension of Better Call Saul is Kim, right, and Mike, Wexler, that's a German name, and so is Ermantraut. So Kim Wexler and Mike Ermantraut, these are two, you could say, ethnic Germans, and they are allies of Jimmy, but they don't really go whole hog, right? Of course, Mike completely loses his morality, becomes the enforcer of Gus, but ultimately, and Kim just backs away after seeing her own sadistic streak, which enjoys tormenting Howard towards the end. Would you like to comment on that? How do Germans fit into the great dance of American ethnicities? And do you think that Mike and Kim represent Germans in this great conflict between WASPs and Jews and maybe Irish?
I don't think so. I don't think it's ever brought up really, although it's interesting that they have Mike killing the German guy whose name I can't even remember, Werner. So that's I guess it is interesting that they have him dealing with the Germans. I'm not sure how that came about. I can't recall. Well, obviously because he's Gus's enforcer, but I guess they wanted German engineers because I guess they're supposed
to be. The Germans are building Gus's drug lab.
But I don't recall anybody saying, oh, and Mike speaks German, so he'll be able to get along with them or something. I don't recall any.
No, he doesn't speak German.
Well, yeah, that's what I was saying. I mean, there's no particular ethnic resonance there, I don't think.
Which Werner points out to him, you know, you're German, you should be friends with us. But no, he's very alienated from them. He's not German. Yeah. He's American, really.
Yeah, exactly. Even though he has a wacky German name, which, you know, you might think had been shortened at some point if they're so assimilated. But Wexler I don't even know what Wex. So you're saying that's German. I haven't even, again, you know, nothing's made of it. I mean, she's just the
Wexler. Wexler sounds to me like changer or changeling. Wechseln is in Wexler. German is to change, right?
Oh, well, that's interesting. Well, that would be interesting. That would be interesting because, you know, it's all about change. You know, she changes. You know, she becomes bad and then she decides not to be bad and becomes good or bland or something. Yeah, I don't know, but I don't think the show itself, unless that's what they were going for with the Wexler name, to sort of like clue
you in. I noticed because if you look at the two shows, right, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, you get people with really distinctively German names. So you get a German name like Miller, and nobody really thinks about it. It was probably Müller at some point. You don't really think of the guy as German, but you get someone named Ermantraut, or in Breaking Bad, the chemist guy, Bedecker.
Oh, yeah.
Like Gail Bedecker, which is Bedecker in German, in the original German. He can't be anything else but German. I keep thinking that Vince Gilligan, for whatever reason, either maybe he just likes German names, which I wouldn't blame him. He deliberately places these German names in front of us. Ermantraut, Wexler, Ziegler, Bedecker, and you know, just for whatever reason, we're supposed to notice that. It's like it has some significance. I keep thinking there is like the undercurrent of ethnic conflict, and of course the Germans we do meet, all four of them in the four shows, Wexler, Ermantraut, Ziegler, they're all technical specialists, right? They're not part of the grand struggle of ego. So there, you have Chuck versus Jimmy, you have Jimmy versus Howard, you have Gus versus the Salamancas, you have Walt versus Gus. But Werner just builds the lab. Kim is a lawyer who helps Jimmy. Ziegler, I mentioned Ermantraut, he's like a specialist cop and detective. And Gail Bedecker, he's just a chemist. He's not really interested in the power plays. So maybe that's the element we're supposed to see. Or maybe I'm just seeing patterns where there are not, with my classic paranoia, which is characteristic of my people.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess just the fact that they don't seem to play much of a role is the message, I guess. They just like fall into the background. Or except for, you know, we keep them around for technical stuff. Yeah. Like I said, Germans are good at technology, so we'll have some Germans in there.
I think that the overarching, you think about why in Breaking Bad Vince Gilligan has Madrigal Electromotive.
That's what I was going to mention, yeah. Madrigal, yeah. Well, it's a German company. Why is it called Madrigal, though?
Right, it's called Madrigal because, I guess, for the same reason that Mercedes-Benz is called Mercedes, right? Hmm. It's at some point, some German guy married a Spanish woman and named his company after it, which is complete beta move. Never name your company after your woman. But yeah,
I'm just trying to think. Yeah, Madrigal is a German company.
So Madrigal Electromotive, massive German multinational company. You're trying to think, and obviously it's a riff on Mercedes, right? Because German company, Spanish name. But also, I believe the degree to which industrial capacity of the West is concentrated on the European continent, and particularly Germany.
Well, yeah.
I don't know what it's supposed to signify. It always seemed like such a strange aspect of Breaking Bad to me. And it comes back on Better Call Saul as the place of employment
for Mike.
I don't know. I just keep thinking there is something of significance there, and maybe I'm not seeing it, or maybe I'm just reading too much into it. What do you think?
It may just be what it is. You know, I mean, maybe that's how things have shaken out in the world. I don't feel any particular message being driven home by that. Because I'm not coming up with any thoughts, memories of watching the series and noticing anything, any points being made about Germany or Germanic stuff or anything like that. Just some subsidiary characters have Germanic names. There's a German holding company that's behind it all. Mike starts working for them because that's how Gus wants to launder the money he's paying. Is there like some sort of like Swiss banking sort of implications there? You know, like they're essentially just criminals in suits. You know, they just launder money and have Swiss bank accounts, or you know, like that sort of mentality, that kind of thing. So you're sort of hinting at that. But that's the thing. I mean, I don't think they're really intentionally doing anything with it. It's just, you know, once you assign the parts to, you know, we'll have some Wasp here, we'll have some Mix here, we'll make Saul a crypto Jew sort of character. There's not much left. Of course, you know, you have all the Mexicans and so on. You know, there's some quasi conspiracy kind of guy on online on YouTube who had a whole thing about where does Gus come from, and they're drawing up stuff from I think from the show itself, although I can't remember any of the details, that Gus is from Pinochet's regime, that he was involved with Pinochet, and
why would he be an Afro-Chilean? Oh, they had the actor, and I think he's like, he's some ungodly combination of ethnicities, like Danish and Italian and black and whatever.
Well, there you go. He can play anything. Right. But I wish I could remember the details. People can probably look it up if they want anything further. But I thought, well, that's interesting because they never really say much about his background other than when he first encounters the cartel. So he's operating outside the cartel and he wants in on their action. But this was supposed to explain various things, including I think how he came to be associated with Madrigal, and also why Hector distrusts him. But there's a point where Hector simply says, "Never trust a South American." But I think there are supposed to be other clues in there that he has some kind of political background. He's like a political refugee, as it were. Like he
intelligence background. Because he
was involved in like the helicopter stuff and all that, you know, that that angle. He was supposed to be in the military.
It would also explain how he knows the guy from Madrigal, right?
Yeah,
that's a little
there's a scene where they meet, where Gus and the guy from Madrigal meet, and there's some cryptic things they say about, you know, like the old days or something like that. I think there's something to that. Possibly.
Yeah, there is a dirty little secret of the German industrial elite that many of them are intelligence assets of services that aren't even supposed to exist anymore. So, like, for example, the director of Nord Stream is a former Stasi agent. He was by complete coincidence, when he was younger, when he was a junior G-man, he was he was stationed in Dresden, right? And he was friends with the KGB representative, a certain Vladimir Vladimirovich.
Yeah, coincidence. Right. What a coinky.
Complete coincidence that now this guy is in charge of the Russian chain around Germany's neck. And
was Merkel actually in the Stasi, or did the people just call her that?
Well, her father was a preacher during the communist period, so they probably had compromise on him. The mm-hmm. East Germans were very thorough. They would have never allowed someone to attain a position of spiritual authority without being compromised by the state. Whether she was in on it or just, you know, it's a dirty secret of Germany. Again, it never purged itself of the old communist personnel, and very few of the countries in Eastern Europe have. right?
Isn't there some Poland is
catching a world of trouble for trying to retire some of the old commie judges right now from the European Union, no less. So, you know,
some ridiculous figure, like one out of six East Germans was either in the Stasi or an informer or something like that. Some ridiculous.
And it's actually true.
Yeah.
It's ridiculously high because it was actually true.
it was a
genuine prison society, not a very nice place to be. And I don't know about Angela Merkel personally, but yeah, German industry, German government, German culture, German everything is lousy with these former Stasi agents. And that's just, you know, state security. There's also the East German Intelligence Service, which had completely infiltrated West German government, industry, culture, everything, almost seamlessly. That was before the Berlin Wall fell. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there's allusions to that. Or maybe it's just that whole normie meme of, oh, Nazis in South America, but
yeah, I was
plot
thinking,
twist.
Yeah, well, there's more to that than... I mean, there's more truth to that than one might think, although I'm sure it's overblown. Getting back to Brother Stair, something I'm working on now, which vaguely ties in with what you were just saying, is his connections to, which a guy who was only a name to me before, William Branham, B-R-A-N-H-A-M, was apparently one of the pioneer faith healers in the 30s and 40s. And this guy, I got to learn more about him. I got a 500-page book that rips the lid off Branham from a former disciple. Utterly fascinating. It gets into a lot of things we've been talking about, actually. How his father was originally a bootlegger. Branham's not his real name. He got an assumed name when he was escaping from murdering someone in Illinois. He eventually became associated with the Second Klan in Indiana. And in the 50s, there was a great falling out between him and one of his major disciples because of this association with the Klan, which had just been revealed. That disciple was Jim Jones. And he was already running the People's Temple in the 50s. This was unknown to me, and was associated with these faith healers. And of course, Jim Jones was a big, you know, I love the black people sort of guy. So when he found out about the Klan connection, he broke with Branham and went off to, you know, go to great glory, as we know. God forbid he should be associated with the Klan. Oh, no, no, no. He's a good guy. He's having audiences with Jimmy Carter and doing all kinds of good stuff in San Francisco, right? So these people are all connected at some level. And the reason I say this, in addition to the prohibition angle and the phony name angle, what you were just saying about South America and Nazis, Branham operated a colony. This is evangelical faith healing type Christianity. Had a colony in Paraguay or Colombia or somewhere in South America, which was associated with the Nazi rat lines after the Second World War. So there were all these German officers and Gestapo people and so on who were hanging out at this particular compound. And I think it had a German name even, which I can't remember. It was really bizarre. It was in South America, but it had a German name, and it was run by these American evangelicals. So they had, I guess they thought it had many levels of cloaking on this. So nobody would suspect that you'd find a German Nazi general there. But there he is hanging out and so on. They got photographs of these people and so on. And somehow that's all connected in with Brother Stair as well. So that we're going to get to the bottom of that. That'll be a big new series. So, yeah, I mean, scratch any famous American and you're going to find a con man and an alias. That's the basic message of Mad Men and Better Call Saul. There's always an alias. Walter White becomes Heisenberg. A German name, right?
German name, a German scientist.
Scary.
Put forth the uncertainty principle, right? That you cannot really determine both the mass and the velocity, or actually the velocity and position of a particle, because by illuminating it, you would, or measuring its velocity, you would alter its position. Or I keep forgetting it. Like it's been years since I read a brief history of time, but I guess there's we're going to have to chew on the symbolism of Madrigal and all the German names popping up in the two series for some time, because ultimately, I don't believe they were put in there by accident. The show is actually too good to believe that things are in there by accident. Although I will say that I think Better Call Saul had already made its point by the time season one ended. You could already see the transformation taking place, right? And
well, that's the thing,
which is something, you know, you don't, you think that things end, culminate, like you make a big, a great choice about your life, and then your life changes dramatically. Whereas in reality, what happens is you make the choice, and then you gradually become the thing that your choice has fated you to make over a period of six seasons. It's
well, that was Schopenhauer's point, that that you're assigned your character, and what happens to you is simply the unfolding of it. So you don't know, your character is part of the phenomenal world, but you don't know what it is until you live your life, and that's in the excuse me, your character is in the noumenal world, so you don't know it. You can only know it as it unfolds in the phenomenal world. So you learn who you are by what you do, what your activities are. You know, Avila had the same notion that, well, you know, Plato, people like that and so on, you know, that, you know, there's a prenatal choice that's made. So in a sense, there's a choice, but it's prenatal. So everything that happens to you afterwards is follows on from those choices.
And the choice is not your own.
I mean, you know,
you're not going to sell that to Westerners, not to modern Westerners. We like to think that we are in charge of our destiny. This is why people are afraid to get on planes, because to get on a plane is to completely surrender control to someone else.
Really?
That's why people are afraid of flying.
Really? I find
What control, what measure of control do you really have over flying on an airplane? You don't. You're strapped in there. You're cargo.
Well,
you might as well be a potato.
Well, I was going to
say, keep you drunk and fucked up on Valium because
no one
is necessary for you.
That's the good part. But I mean, I mean, my difficulty with flying is that last part. I mean, being strapped into a stainless steel tube. You know, it's not the statistics about flying and so on. I mean, if you look at statistics, it's safer than crossing the street, you know, but people don't think of it that way. But, you know, if I could, you know, somebody once described the Star Trek as being like the white middle class sort of ideal of the future, you know, sitting in a comfy chair, watching TV and flying through the universe. And, you know, if we could fly like that, I wouldn't have any problems with flying. Just, you know, sit in a big comfy chair, you know, huge control room and so on, right? Screen, flat screen TV and so on, you know. But, there's in Galaxy Quest, the interspace travel method is some sort of goo that surrounds you and then shoots you into the universe. So it's just like you inside this viscous fluid. Right, just like trapped inside this viscous fluid and so on. And of course, anyone who goes through it, any human that we see go through it is screaming in panic. So it's not a comfortable way to travel, you know, but it's probably quite safe. You know? Who wants to travel like that? You
know, I guess Jerry Seinfeld was right that the ultimate male fantasy is to hurtle through the galaxy from the comfort of your living room, like the Starship Enterprise.
Was he the origin of that Star Trek thing?
Yeah, it's from one of his stand-up routines, which bookends the Seinfeld episodes.
But yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those things, once you see it, you can't unsee it.
He was very good at making observations, that Jerry Seinfeld. He's one of the good ones, unironically. I'm sorry. We're already over time, James. So if you have any closing thoughts on the Saul Goodman question, now's the time to voice them.
Closing thoughts? Oh, I don't know. Just a couple of things. You know, do Saul or Walt deserve redemption? This is the problem I had with Star Wars. You know, Better Call Saul is sort of like the prequels to Star Wars, where they took what should have been a simple character who was a bad guy, and they said, you know what people want? They want 9 hours to explain his backstory. And they didn't. They didn't really. And so one might think the Better Call Saul was, you know, six years of explaining the backstory of a character, but it's much more successful than Star Wars prequels. Or it might have turned out like The Hobbit. You know, you take a simple book and say, oh, people will definitely want to spend 9 hours watching the backstory to Lord of the Rings. They love Lord of the Rings, so they'll watch this. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. But I think Better Call Saul succeeds, though, with that minor problem. I'm not sure if Saul or Walt or Darth Vader really deserve the sort of redemption that we're supposed to imagine that they get. Some weird way they become heroes to people, even though in real life they're wretched human beings. One final thought.
It's like the thing when once you mentioned Darth Vader, the first show before Better Call Saul is Breaking Bad, right? So Walter White is supposed to break bad. But as we know from Mike's speech and from Walter admitting it to Skyler in the final episode, he didn't break bad. He was always like that.
He was always like that,
but he was just too cowardly to be himself.
Yeah.
So in a sense, you know, we mock these people. Oh, you're a beta male. You're pussy whipped. You're this and that. Maybe you want him like that. You don't know what you're unlocking when you mock someone into taking action.
Right. You want to keep them as Dark Helmet, not Darth Vader. So one final thing that I learned during the prep for this episode is that the origin of Better Call Saul. So the writers were sitting around and they had talked about a couple of things that they thought wouldn't happen, like winning a Peabody Award, or people would want to buy Los Pollos Hermanos t-shirts. And both of those things came true. And so they said, you know, we should do something with this Saul character. Let's make a show based on Saul. And so it came to be. In other words, it's another example of positive thinking. It's another example. After a couple of incidents where they were just throwing ideas around in the room that they couldn't believe anyone would possibly go for, and it actually worked. Their third idea they came up with was, well, what about a Saul show? So just like being a con man and so on, it's typically American. It's the power of positive thinking that brought us Better Call Saul. So there we are. And that's my final contribution. And that's my story. I'm sticking to it.
And that's fascinating. That is indeed fascinating. Well, I think we can consider Saul well and truly called.
Yes. He has been.
I'm going to be shot eventually for these horrible punks. There's going to be a sniper on the opposite building, and he's going to shoot me in the fucking head. And that's the power of positive thinking for you. Right? I should be so lucky.
Mike is fighting his sniper rifle even as we speak.
Indeed. The rifle is being manufactured as we speak. I guess let me just double check the entropy links and see if there are any more donations. Nope. No new donations. So I guess this has been the writer's block. I'm your friend and host, Nick Gilvey, and tonight's guest was James O'Meara. We were discussing Better Call Saul, which is an American TV show. And I want to thank everyone who donated tonight. Your contributions are what keeps this operation trucking along. I want to thank all of our moderators and for keeping the chat safe. Everyone who watched, everyone listening to the replay, it is for you for whom we perform this dance week after week. And yep, I guess that's it.
Bye-bye, okay, people. Thanks to all our donators.
Better call Saul.
Yeah. If you want to make money and keep the money you make, better call Saul.
Bye-bye.